You're listening to Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about markup and templates for content management systems with special guest, Allison Wagner. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com/click and use the offer code CLICK.
Control Click would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor of the year. Hey, Leah, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not too bad. So I know you've only been in Seattle about 6 months, but did you catch the football game yesterday?
I caught part of it. I was actually doing a wine and dining thing with a bunch of girlfriends. So we missed.
Sounds awesome.
We missed a majority of it, but we couldn't really miss it because everywhere we went, people were in Seahawks gear. And then how we kept up with the scores essentially when there was a cheer. And then when we went out for dinner, there was like one TV in that restaurant, and we didn't know what was going on until suddenly there was like this roar, and we're like, I guess we won.
That's cool. I've actually never been in the city of a winning team as like an adult. I mean, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and the Redskins went to the Super Bowl a few times back then, but that must be really exciting, that sort of energy.
Well, I have mixed feelings because I'm not much of a, well, I'm so Canadian, the only sport I really know is hockey. So it's kind of like football, yay, home team, you know? But I'm happy for Seattle and I'm happy for people that are fans of the game and all that fun stuff.
Well, and I'm sure like some of your new neighbors and friends in the area, you're going to get invited to at least one really good Super Bowl party.
Yeah, and I'm actually looking forward to the food more than even the game. It's just like, what will we prepare for a Super Bowl party?
Mm-hmm. Well, and do you know about the whole commercials at Super Bowl time?
Oh, yeah. They are? Oh, yeah, okay. Of course, because they're so massive and then they become viral sometimes too.
Right.
So, yeah, for sure.
Well, that should be fun then. So, good.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll be my first like real huge sporting kind of experience in the States. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, let's go ahead and get into some news in the world of content management systems. To start with, Perch released an update, version 2.4, that fixes some bugs, but also introduces a few new features. One of these features is interesting. You know, I really want to get my hands on Perch so I can see how some of this works, but it's something called template dividers, and right in your with your template tags, you can generate some markup to split a template into sections without actually, from what I can understand, writing the markup yourself. It sort of just generates it directly for you in the user interface. So that's kind of interesting, especially considering what we're going to be talking about today.
Very cool. And in other CMS news, Craft has released another update to its contact form plugin to support multiple email addresses.
And I'm not sure if this is new or just new to me, but I saw a link on the EECMS hashtag for this link on Ellis Lab's site. It's ellislab.com/expressionengine/y. And it's like a little marketing slideshow resource thingy that highlights the reasons to use Expression Engine. This was the first time I came across it, and I thought it was nice because I want to see Ellis Lab doing more things like this. I feel they just need to do more marketing to build name recognition for Expression Engine.
Mm-hmm.
Just based on the number of RFPs and job requests that we see, almost none ever mention Expression Engine. And so there's already a hurdle that we have to get over to educate our clients about what other options are out there other than WordPress or something like that. But I will say, I was also a little confused about this tool because it seems a little multiple personality in the sense that some of the points are relevant to EE devs like you and me, and some are kind of relevant to our clients who are making the decision on what tool they might want to use or what kind of agency they want to go with and what that agency might work with. And I thought that was sort of weird because I wouldn't want to send that link to a prospective client because I don't think half of the points are relevant to their perspective. So I'm kind of torn on it, but it did remind me of that tool that Michael Boink and Marcus Netto put together, I think early, was it early last year or late 2012? But it was basically Expression Engine at a Glance. We'll have the link in our show notes. And they say it's aimed at newbie developers, but I really think it's a much more effective resource for a prospective client to get a sense of all of the options that they could have if Expression Engine is the tool for their CMS.
Yeah, I think it's always a balancing act over, well, who's the audience mm-hmm. here? Because the way you speak to a client, but you know, which client are you talking about? Like, is the client a more technically inclined client, or are you talking towards marketing type of person or mm-hmm. business person that just simply wants to understand how flexible the system is?
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the news for today. If we overlook news about a CMS you favor or are interested in, let us know and we'll get it on our radar for future episodes.
All right. So I'm really excited about today's episode because we're going to talk about markup, which is my favorite topic of absolutely anything related to web development. I love HTML the most. We have a special guest, Allison Wagner, joining us to talk about the markup and templates for content management systems. Allison is a front-end developer for Happy Cog, where she specializes in the art of abstracting design systems from comps to code. When she's not coding, she's sharing her knowledge about coding, speaking at conferences, writing for Web Standards Sherpa and Happy Cog's Cognition, and teaching for Girl Develop It. Welcome to the show, Allison. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you both doing?
Great.
Pretty good. So Allison, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I work in the Philly office of Happy Cog. I have a house here. Really into music. I'm actually going to a concert on Wednesday to go see a Gene Clark, no other like super group of Beach House and Grizzly Bear and like members of a few other awesome alternative kind of bands. And I like to go to flea markets. So that's a little bit more about me. I'm so happy to be here. Yay.
Well, we're really excited you were able to join us because you had to have your wisdom teeth extracted last week.
Oh, no. Yes, I did. Yeah, that was the worst. But I'm on the up and up now, so I'm doing much better. Thank you.
So before we get into some of the specific questions that we have about markup for content management systems, I kind of wanted to get a peek behind the curtain of Happy Cog in the sense of how do you work? Like, you work as a developer for them. Do you work in teams of two or more people, or are you independent where you're just handed projects and you just build the front end and that just get hands off to someone else, or how's it all work?
Yeah, so I've been at Happy Cog now for 4 years, 4.5 years, and the company has gone through quite a genesis, I think, over the last 4 years, specifically the last year. When I started, I think there were like 11 or 12 people, and now we're up to like 30. And we used to kind of sell the company that, you know, when you work with Happy Cog, you work with the entire team. Since then, we've kind of split into small teams of 5 or 6 people each, and they're actually cross-office. We have several offices, one in Austin, one in New York, and then one in Philly. And so there's about 5 to 6 team members that tackle projects individually as if it's like their own little independent company, which is nice because it's a lot of opportunity for innovation, and we can try new things within each kind of like small group, and then we have like lunch and learns, that kind of deal, and then share like our findings. So there's a lot of opportunity there to try new things and like have it cross-office collaboration and all that kind of deal. So we are involved from the very beginning. So after the sales team kind of secures the job, then we have a sales to project transition meeting and we go right into stakeholder interviews, and we're super collaborative. So like I'm involved in stakeholder interviews and I'm, you know, doing requirements gathering and that kind of a thing and helping with wireframing and all that kind of jazz. So yeah, I'm not just like in a developer hole kind of a thing, like off by myself, like sad. I'm working with the team and being involved in all phases. So it's like a really interesting kind of newer way to approach templates and, you know, development in general. So yeah, I'm like really happy with the direction that we're moving.
Cool. So do you find yourself working with different people for different projects, or are you kind of always working with the same people each time within your own, you know, team or office, I guess?
Right. Well, so generally working with the same people. This is all very new. We really just kind of started it in September. There was talk that we would do team structure for a year and then reevaluate and kind of see what the pros and cons were, and then like possibly like shuffle people around based on strength and what they're actually interested in working on, because teams are kind of curtailed right now for like what it is they actually want to focus on. And they're, you know, people are strategically put into teams based on their strengths and weaknesses, like hoping that people, you know, will come together and kind of like fill in the blanks where necessary. But then also, you know, there's always going to be times where there's overlap or someone is out unexpectedly, that kind of a deal. So I still pop into other projects and like help out where I can, QA, that kind of deal. So I'm still working with other people at the company. We're not entirely isolated, but we do primarily work with our small group.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get into web design and development? Was that what you went to school for?
Not really, no. I thought I was going to be a pharmaceutical sales rep.
Or wow.
Yeah.
That's my mom was.
Yeah, my whole family's in pharmaceuticals, like my mom, my dad, my uncle, my sister, everybody. And so I thought I was going to go that route. I went to school for biology, and then I didn't like it. And I always kind of maybe thought I'd do like journalism or something more creative. I always kind of had like a creative bent to me. So I switched over to school communications and I went to Temple University. And they had just started an advertising program. So I think I was in like the second class to graduate from the advertising program. Oh. And in my senior year, there was a class, it was like interactive design or something like that. And there was the professor, rather, Jade Snyder, worked at Saatchi and Saatchi Interactive. And she kind of introduced us to the idea that people make websites and like the process behind it. And I just really kind of fell in love with the idea. And I like downloaded Photoshop and took some Lynda classes on Photoshop, and like being able to manipulate graphics and imagery was super awesome. So then I started designing site for myself. I was making jewelry at the time, so I wanted to make like a site for my jewelry making. And after I designed it, I just kind of started to build it as well. I mean, I was in Dreamweaver doing, you know, drag and drop kind of, you know, like super WYSIWYG development at that point, but it was a nice way to get my feet wet. And I just kind of fell in love with the process of translating design into development, like abstracting it into the values and all that kind of thing. Like that was really interesting to me. So once I built my own site, I got hired like right out of school, and I was mid-size ad agency over in Jersey doing like email blasts and flash animations, you know, paying my dues. But while I was there, I was also doing tutorials and that kind of stuff. And I was like reading a lot of CSS tricks and Smashing Mag and continuing with the Lynda. And there's all those PSD to HTML tutorials and that kind of stuff. So I was just like spending a lot of time trying to teach myself best practices and get into just like specifically web development. I thought I was actually going to be a web designer at first. And then I found myself much more suited for dev. But yeah, so that was kind of I was there for a year, and then I went to HappyCog. And I thought I was actually going to be an intern at HappyCog, but they liked my portfolio. I had like taken on a project. My dad was on like the board for his community, like I don't know, whatever. And they wanted a website. So I like learned WordPress so that I could build them this site. And I think they were impressed by that. So I was just like, I'm like, when people say self-taught in web development, it depends on how isolated you are. You know, I was not terribly isolated. I was working with a team at HappyCog, so I was like still like, you know, continuing to learn, and I'm still learning to this day. So it's a balance of like having the tenacity or, you know, the
initiative.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. To like read up and, you know, always like stay thirsty for knowledge or whatever. And then also working with a team and sharing your findings and that kind of a thing. So yeah, now here I am 4.5 years later, and I just absolutely love it.
So speaking of learning new things, how did that transition to picking up content management systems and learning more? You mentioned WordPress. Was that the first system you started fiddling with?
Yeah. So I started there, and there's just like a ton of documentation on WordPress. So I was like, I think that's a really good starter CMS for people, just because that there is so much hand-holding, and or not hand-holding, but there's like so much or so
resources.
Many, yes, like awesome tutorials and stuff online that you can just like type in to Google like exactly what you want to learn, and somebody's written an article on it, you know. So I started there, and eventually I taught myself Expression Engine, because that would be the primary CMS that we were using at HappyCog. And that was like, because I think previously CMSs in general were like a black box to me. So we would, or I would write HTML, you know, because I was just primarily doing static websites, and I didn't, all this unknown around a CMS was like super scary to me, and I didn't really like know what I was scared of. You know, I guess that's probably part of the fear. But like once I started to learn about variables and like how that like plugs content into your static HTML and how CMSs actually work with databases and that kind of thing, it like demystifying that like took a lot of the hesitation I had around the CMS like topic in general, and kind of like made me more comfortable with it. And then that confidence, you know, carries through into your work and like how you approach development in general.
Yeah. And it also just makes, especially if you're working with other people, the conversations easier. You can use the right terms to convey something when you have the context of how the CMS interacts with your markup. I remember that point for myself when I learned Expression Engine for the first time. There was that light bulb moment.
Yeah, I read, I think Ryan Ireland actually, who works for Happy Cog, wrote a book, Learning Expression Engine, and like reading that, and you know, was huge for me because it was just like, I don't know, this is going to sound like an adverse book, but it was like really, really like clear and just kind of like reading through it. And I remember I had like so many aha moments just in like the first chapter alone, like, oh, okay, this makes sense. You just put this, you know, variable here and then it prints out the whatever they've added into the admin. And it just like, it just started to make sense about how static templates and a CMS interact, and it helped me tremendously. Just, I think just kind of diving in and like learning things that you're even just on like a surface level, if you're not going to go like, you know, whole hog into a project, just like at least familiarizing yourself with the topic helps tremendously, at least for me. Cause if it's a confidence thing and you're like hesitant to talk about it with your coworkers, cause you don't want to reveal how little you know, like that kind of thing. Like, yeah. I don't want to have to negotiate that kind of personal politic. I just want to be able to like feel confident about something. So that was really awesome. Like learning Expression Engine, I'd say even more so than WordPress, was like huge for me, being able to build a full site from start to finish and untouched kind of a thing from outside was pretty big. And I did that a lot in my freelance career. I used Expression Engine a lot.
Oh, so in, you know, not, you don't just do like the templates, but you also would do the development in the CMS, yeah, you know, building out your custom fields and channels and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So you've worked with WordPress, Expression Engine, anything else, even just testing something or experimenting?
Well, I've written templates for Drupal, but I haven't done any Drupal dev, and then also crafted as well, but I haven't done any craft dev. I've just done templates for them, and I'm sure I've done templates for other systems as well, but as far as like being involved on the front end, the back end, that would be WordPress and Expression Engine.
So amongst those three, were there any unique approaches you needed to follow with your markup to support, let's say, the Drupal templates, or could you just write straight up markup and you trusted that your CMS dev just took it from there?
Well, Expression Engine is really nice because I feel like it's minimally invasive in templates. Like pretty much what you write is what's going to appear on the front end for the finished product. Drupal, I've worked on two Drupal projects, and the first one, we learned a lot of lessons just as far as our process goes. You know, so I would work with the back end developer, and we were typically working waterfall at the time. So I would complete templates entirely, and then I handed them off to the backend developer for Drupal. And we found that probably wasn't the best approach because Drupal does kind of have a lot of front-end implications. They do like add classes and markup and that kind of thing, and it was much more of a beast to work with. And I understand that there's like a lot of positives with working with Drupal, but as far as the front-end implications go specifically, there's a lot more you have to kind of take into account. It doesn't just like leave your templates as is, like clean. So just dealing with their own CSS that they added as well. So we made changes to the process moving forward. If we're, you know, going to use Drupal, just make sure that there's time for me to go back in after the backend dev has completed coding or is midway through coding or content's being entered, to make sure that things are kind of like looking correct and that the Drupal CSS isn't overriding things in some instances, because that happened and there was some complications involved. But then there was the next Drupal project that we worked on went a lot smoother because lessons were learned, and we just accounted for it in terms of time.
So when you're talking about accounting for it, though, can you talk about a little bit more specific? Because waterfall is pretty straightforward, like you finish your templates then hand it off, but now it sounds like it's a little bit more collaborative. Like, how does that work when it's still like what you're still building is still ongoing, the CSS is still, you know, in the process, and then he's still trying to plug in the Drupal code or whatever code. How do you communicate where to stop and send the other dev something?
Yeah, so I would like complete a suite of templates, maybe like 3 or 4 templates, and then pass them to him. I mean, and this whole time, like, communication is huge and planning is huge. So just making sure that I was being resourced specifically, you know, because I work in an organization, I'm not just army of one or whatever, making sure that my time, like I have time every week to go back and like check and make sure that things are being implemented correctly and classes are being translated over and that things aren't getting overwritten and that the classes that are applied are correct, that kind of a deal. Like just kind of making sure that we're accounting for all the variables and things that happen when you're implementing into Drupal. So I think it's just like with Expression Engine, when I was done templates, you know, and done meaning that I had written all the HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and then QA'd across all the browsers and devices, sure, that kind of thing. Like you could traditionally say like, okay, then I'm done this project as a front-end developer, I can move on to the next project. But with Drupal specifically, you're not really done. You have to kind of like stay in the loop with things and just kind of check back. And we use Sifter, which is bug tracking system. Mm-hmm. So tickets would be logged there, or like as pages were completed or templates were completed, there'd be a ticket logged and I'd have to go back and check to make sure that things kind of translated nicely. And it's just like making sure that communication is key. And we all work in the office here. So Anthony, who I worked with on Black Hills, which was our Drupal project, he would just like tap me on the shoulder kind of a deal. And I'd roll my chair over and we'd look at something together as to why it's not printing correctly and typically solve the problem like fairly fast. But just making sure that you have a good relationship with your coworkers, which mm-hmm. is huge, you know, obviously.
So when it comes to a CMS, maybe not so much right now while you're working with HappyCog, although maybe you are kind of have a window into the sales process, but you know, even when you were freelancing, how the templating works for a CMS, did that influence what CMS was chosen for a project?
Yeah, I think, any CMS that spits out junk markup or inaccessible markup, less than ideal markup that like is unchanging and hard to control would take a lot of effort on our part to like overwrite the default system would probably be thrown out the window immediately because mm-hmm. we pride ourselves on accessible content. And so we have, you know, like 3 or 4 that we'll use, because we actually do something called like a tech approach where we'll go through and kind of test each or rank each CMS against like a set of criteria and like mm-hmm. make sure exactly all the requirements are being met. And this is after like stakeholder interviews and that kind of thing. So we kind of know the client a little bit and like what their expectation is and what they're looking for. And we're typically doing like very content heavy sites, not so much app sites.
So after you've chosen a CMS to work with, or the company you're working with has chosen a CMS to work with, the next step obviously is to start getting working with the project. One thing that I've heard of when I talk to other devs about templating is the DRY or dry process with front-end templates. What's your thoughts about that process when you're doing any front-end coding for a CMS?
Yeah, I think that the best approach is your own personal, well, is an approach that you're very comfortable with. So like have super sound starter files with conventions that you're familiar with as far as classing and that kind of thing goes. And then just kind of really focus on making sure that those are like super solid and sound so that you can use that over and over again. And then that kind of helps you create your system and you know going into templating like what your classes are going to look like and how things are going to be set up. So I try to keep things, it's a healthy balance. You don't want to be too dry and then maybe have like a body class and have that override everything and mm-hmm, then mm-hmm. you're getting super specific and then you're fighting with yourself and you're not using CSS to its fullest, you're not, you know, using the cascade or inheritance. I like to keep things super modular, so I will mm-hmm. class and a div or an aside or a section with, you know, if it's like a call out or something, I'll do a class of call out, and then the like H2, H3, H4 that appear inside of it will take a default style and the P will take a default style and that kind of thing. So I'm kind of classing based on the module instead of the page itself. And that kind mm-hmm. of helps keep things low level. As a general rule, I try not to go more than 3 selectors in a string because I feel like once you're there, your 4 just feels like too much to me and you're sure. not really using the system. Like you're not using CSS for how it could be and it just starts to take up too much time and that kind of deal. So keeping classes like 1 to 2 on a module if there's like, you know, call out and then call out alt or something, because call out alt has like a border and a shadow, or like the heading color is different. Targeting that way based on the module instead of on individual elements inside of it. But then, you know, like, don't make it hard for yourself. If you have to add a class, add a class, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't like, mm-hmm. you know, spend too much time like mulling over whether or not you should add a class here or not. Like, if you need to, then you need to, and you can always go back and change it if necessary. But this also speaks to just kind of planning in general. When you have your design system kind of all set out in front of you, making sure that you're scanning all of the templates and looking for the smallest units of design, and then coding them, and then using the default styles that you've already written to your advantage. Just always looking for things that repeat, text transform, uppercase on all like metadata, you know, and just make sure that you're looking for those patterns and mm-hmm. writing them in early, and mm-hmm. then overriding them when necessary. But that sound base is going to support a sound design system.
So those base resources, or I think you refer to them as like your starter files, are they where you are at HappyCog? Is it something that's like the whole team uses the same kind, or each developer has their own set of what naming conventions and things make sense to them?
Yeah, we have HappyCog starter files, which we traditionally use and then update. And we actually just updated to a grunt away from CodeKit. So we're always changing them and updating them based on what's going on, what's the best, I guess, approach, or like how we feel like things are moving in a certain direction. And it's nice because I think at this point, gosh, we probably have like 10 developers, maybe 12 developers. So when we're all using the same starter files and then making updates as necessary and then committing them up to GitHub with a comment as to why you changed the starter file, and then everyone kind of like learns from that. So mm-hmm. it's a shared resource that we use across projects. There have been times when we're doing internal projects, that kind of thing, where people will kind of go their own way and like as an opportunity to experiment, which I think is smart, and then port those same ideas back to our starter files and kind of try to like help the whole team out. As a whole, we'll have like dev meetings and talk about like what's going on in the development community and what are some things that are worth trying and what you've learned and what you don't like, that kind of deal. And that's like very helpful as well. But the starter files are crucial. And I have my own personal starter files that I use as well. That's in a freelance capacity, and they're like far more like scaled back. Mm-hmm. But the HappyCog starter files are like pretty robust and like awesome as well. I'm a big fan of them. We're always revisiting them and discussing them and that kind of thing.
Since Leigh and I are now working together, we're moving in this direction ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been writing HTML and CSS as long as I can even remember. It's been forever, but I've never created like starter files or base resources.
Really?
Though I would often basically copy what I had done from my last project and yeah. kind of tweak that. So in a way, I sort of did, but with the goal of trying to be more modular, kind of as you described, and also inspired a bit by Jonathan Snook, Scalable and Modular CSS, mm-hmm. then I've been trying to create these base resources and creating modules within them. And they're, you know, in my head, I was like, oh, I'll just create them and they'll be done. And no, I create them. And every time I touch HTML, I find some new way I could approach it. So I go back and I have to update those resources so they reflect the current knowledge. And then making them available to Leigh so she's got those at her ready if she ever mm-hmm. needs to utilize them. It's one of those things that it makes so much sense.
Yep.
But you may not think of doing it because it takes time to get those resources together.
It does, but it saves so much time in the end. And just having those like class conventions that you already, you know, use, like we use like .btn or whatever as our button class, that makes mm-hmm. sense, right? And then like .more, M-O-R-E, for like a read more link and that kind of thing. But just like having those things readily available and kind of like a second language that you just know when you look at a link that that's what it should be classed. And then everybody on the team also knows that that's what it's going to be classed because that's what we're using. And that's like our convention really helps speed up the process too. Cause you're reducing your cognitive load of like, this is what I don't have to think about what I'm going to class it necessarily. Right. Like, mm-hmm. or I'm just like reducing that time. So it's just faster that way. And having those base styles associated with those classes, just, yeah,
is there,
big time saver. I'm a huge starter files fan.
So is there like some sort of documentation regarding this? Because, for example, you mentioned that, okay, if you see BTN, that means that's a button class that's going to be starting. And then there's another one that's called more. But how do you decide which class would be abbreviated like BTN versus spelled out completely like more?
Not entirely sure like where like why we name things exactly how they do, but they make sense to me and I know them. And yeah. So we just continue down that path. I guess we could get rid of all vowels or something like that and just like keep them as super short as possible. But then there's that balance between like, can I actually just look at it and know exactly what it is? Or do I have to like look at it and then translate it in my head to English so that it makes sense to me? So kind of just finding that healthy balance, making sure that you actually understand what it is. Like, I want to be able to look at a class and know what it does. And that, I think that also just comes with time and being familiar with the starter files. But once you're there and it's like super helpful.
All right. So before we go on, we'd like to take a moment again to thank our sponsor, Squarespace. Back when I taught interface design at McEwen, a lot of students actually signed up for Squarespace to have an attractive portfolio up and running really quickly. And that included a few technologically challenged students. So if you want something that easy, why not go for a free trial and 10% off your first purchase? All you need to do is go to squarespace.com/click and use offer code click. Now, back to the topic at hand.
You know, I was thinking, Allison, when you were describing how you choose BTN versus spelling out button, you know, I think one of the things that I've come to understand working just as a team of one, but then also with Leia, is that it's really picking something and going with it consistently, you know, and I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, once you understand what the BTN class does, it's not really a matter of needing things to be overly verbose, but it just needs to be understood within the team. But not just the styles that Button has, but the styles that that class has on maybe a UL versus a P versus any other type of markup you may be associating it with. I feel like that's one of my biggest frustrations about some of the frameworks that are out there is that their class naming conventions, they aren't, like people say it's so great for rapid prototyping, but if you have to spend 10 minutes trying to understand their naming conventions, how is that useful?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, the same would go for someone new coming into HappyCog and looking at our starter files and like having to understand them. But I think where the difference between the prototyping classes, which are largely non-semantic and just kind of, you know, they're speaking to, well, they're certain, yeah, like grids and like what the actual appearance is and small text and large text, that kind of a thing. Like those are the kinds of classes that they use. We're using classes that maybe are a little bit more semantic and relevant to what the actual content is inside of it. Because like I said, we do a lot of content-heavy sites, so there's going to be some repetition across like what we're actually building. There's going to be call-outs on the side and as far as, you know, other types of content, I see it time and time again. There's patterns that you can just kind of see from our various clients, like, and making sure that, you know, we're coding for them appropriately.
So I know you wrote about frameworks for us a little bit last year for Web Standard Sherpa. Do you, you know, if you have starter files, would you use those for a quick prototype or would you rely on a framework, like an external framework or something?
For a prototype?
Yeah, like one of the things I'm finding as I'm building these base resources is that because, you know, my class naming is semantic and I understand it and Leia understands it, like I'd rather use my base resources to quickly throw something together rather than using something like Foundation or Bootstrap or something like that.
Yeah. So at HappyCog, we actually have someone who kind of specializes in prototyping, and he uses Foundation. And I've popped in to help him at times, and generally he's far enough along that I can kind of just like look at what he's already done. And I'll go to the Foundation documentation as well and refer to that. But by and large, I can just kind of like look at his template so far and just grab things and reuse what's already there as opposed to spending a ton of time trying to actually learn the system. I guess it depends on how robust your starter files are. We have a grid system already kind of set up. It's in SAS, that kind of thing, so that it's already using functions to push out flexible width, percentage base, or whatever, and using that. I'm not sure exactly what I would do, actually, if I was going to prototype. I don't know if our starter files are robust enough to kind of, because our prototyping is, like, super fast. I mean, he's, like, pumping out, like, a design a day kind of a thing, which is not the pace that I'm working when I'm doing templates. So I like Foundation. I think it's a good system, but I probably would be just more comfortable in our starter files because, you know, I'm like so familiar with them. So I probably would take the starter files approach, actually, if I was tasked to do a full prototype.
Yeah, I think based on your answer, I think the question is, I guess it's about your role. If your job is prototyping, which I didn't realize there was like a job like that where you just cranked out like wireframes and stuff like that. That sounds pretty cool. Versus someone who's doing really custom front-end development, I feel like the latter, myself or you, might be more comfortable working with something that's like the starter files versus a framework. But if you're doing what your colleague is doing, yeah, I could see how that makes more sense. So I guess the question's a bit more nuanced.
Yeah, I almost feel like I would go into like a previous internal project and scrape out anything that was like highly customized and then just use that as my basis for, you know, the prototype. I think I maybe go that route.
So you've talked about some things that really sound like best practices in terms of markup and by extension templating. Are there any other best practices that you have in terms of workflows or even points of communication with your team members when you're doing templating for a content management system?
Well, we have a design to development transition meeting where we'll go through what's been designed thus far and kind of like talk about values and identifying where things could probably be consolidated in terms of design to reduce dev time, that kind of thing. So I think communication and having a really good relationship with your designer is probably key. But then also I am a huge fan of SCSS specifically. I'm using that. And I feel like that technology is at this point a necessity when you're doing large scale template dev. It just saves so much time. Mm-hmm. Using variables, that kind of thing is crucial. And at this point, it's built into our starter files. That's how we do things. And we're educating clients on SAS and SCSS and how to generate the screen file, that kind of deal. And so far, we've had 100% buy-in. Everybody loves it. So that would be probably the key, is make sure that you're on the up and up with pre-processing. It's the way that we're moving, and it makes so much sense. It really like reinvigorated my like passion.
Totally. I know exactly what you mean.
But it was another way to refine and abstract and make things like better and smaller and smarter. And yeah, it forced me to like rethink how I was templating in, you know, and like writing classes and that kind of thing. It's like saved so much time. And now when I have to go back and like look at vanilla CSS projects or make updates on them, I'm like pulling my hair out. Like, I can't believe I was doing this before. And there's just like so many little things that kind of help save you time, and keep consistency is key, you know? So just establishing those values in variables early that will translate across your full design system, it helps reinforce the idea of it being an actual system and not just like a bunch of styles that are, you know, attached to classes and that are attached to markup.
Right.
So we've been talking a lot about your workflow with development and with other devs and all these kind of things. And then you kind of hinted at it just a few moments ago, talking about client buy-in. Now, clients are an interesting breed in that sometimes they have a lot of technical knowledge or not very much. And certain clients want a lot of customization, and other clients are just fine inputting content into the CMS. I'm wondering if you believe that the clients need to access certain sections or customization options, like layout options and things like that. Would you build a template differently for that CMS to allow access, for example, for a client to certain parts of the template? Or do you lock that down?
Yeah, no, I mean, I want to make sure that the template system that they're handed is flexible enough to certainly handle all of the content that they're going to need to support on the site. But then also there's layout varieties, that kind of a deal. Make sure that that's being accurately represented and that things don't fall apart if it's missing a sidebar or something like that. So we want to code for all of those instances and just kind of making sure that the outliers are being taken care of. By and large, the companies that Happy Cog's working with are large and have someone who is fairly proficient, at least in web, on their team internally to kind of like take things over. We don't do a lot of maintenance per se, at least right now. I think we're maybe moving into that, but by and large, we would come in, do their website, and then kind of hand off to them to like continue to build, because a website's never really complete, right? You're always adding content to it, always changing things, mm-hmm. things, you know, there's new technologies, that kind of deal. You'll have to keep it evolving. So making sure that like the client is very comfortable in the CMS and, you know, able to add content and is not scared of the system. It's all about education, just making sure that they're on board with the CMS chosen and that they feel 100% confident that the system that we've built for them is going to take them into the future. And like, you know, they're going to have many years of success. I mean, I don't know how many years of success, but at least several, hopefully, you know, I would say that's a sign of success.
I think at least thus far with my, I guess, freelance career, most of my clients lack understanding of HTML and CSS. Mm-hmm. And so for the most part, I do not let them touch templates. If they do, they're going to end up paying me a lot to fix what they mess up.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I try to do is identify what types of content they need to enter and where can I avoid giving them a WYSIWYG where they could actually affect HTML? Where can it be just discrete content that they don't have the ability to mess with the markup? And then where they do get a WYSIWYG editor, you know, where they could potentially go into the source and enter other HTML that I've tried to restrict based on like maybe the formatting dropdown or the styles dropdown in the WYSIWYG editor, depending on which one you're using. But wherever that content falls inside an HTML template, I wrap it in a div called from editor.
There you
and
go,
then I override all this, like I'll just imagine what they could possibly be enter into them. And I use that as my, to kick off the string for the selector to make sure that all the styles, even if they put an H1 in there when that's not technically what we want them to do, it's going to visually look at least the way it should if it were maybe an H3, which is what we did want them to have.
I feel like that would be like a really fantastic code snippet, is like all the worst client content entry that's available, and then like have that in your your, you know, template or whatever, just to test against to make sure that when they're entering content into the WYSIWYG that it does print out correctly. Because that's what mm-hmm. I do too. Like we'll add a class of WYSIWYG or something to a field that's going to, you know, get a WYSIWYG and test to make sure that when things don't line up correctly or when the markup that was, I guess, generated by the WYSIWYG isn't 100% awesome or less than, you know, that
or throws in a bunch of line breaks every time, things like that.
Yeah, BR. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like that kind of stuff. Like we're making sure that things don't fall apart. But then it does kind of come to them as well. Like, you know, they need to be looking at the previews or, you know, the published pages and making sure that the content is mm-hmm. entered or is printing correctly. And then, you know, also I'll go in after content is entered and kind of clean things up and make sure that things look okay, and then let them know like what kind of things moving forward they should watch for, that kind of thing. So it's kind of like a lessons at the end to help like educate them, you know.
That's a nice idea. I like that.
Yeah, just so that they don't make those mistakes moving forward after we're not like actively engaged with them. Yeah, and they appreciate that. And then, you know, they'll also post bugs in Sifter or that kind of thing if they're having issues with a content entry, or I can just like see it right away. But yeah, that's a matter of the front end dev coming back in after back end and content is entered and making sure that things kind of like look appropriate.
Oh, I like that step. Leia, I think we need to get that in our workflow.
Yeah. No, I mean, that reminds me a little bit, even in the design world, right? Like when you're doing identity design and in the traditional print world, whenever you design a logo, in the brand guidelines, you have like an entire page saying, this is what you should not do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you should not angle the logo this way. You should not stretch the logo this way. And in some ways, this is basically in like the WYSIWYG. It's like, okay, here are the best practices and here's what you should try to avoid so it doesn't break.
Yep.
Yeah, pretty cool.
So I kind of wanted to, for the last bit of this conversation, talk about the notion of generated markup. And by that, I'm talking about whether it's the CMS or even like an add-on for the CMS. And what it spits out is not just the data. It's also whatever the CMS or add-on developer deemed was the proper markup for the given output. For example, I remember, I think this was before EE version 2, the comment form. You just mm-hmm. put in a tag and it generated all the form markup for you. And I couldn't get in there and make my labels and inputs and all that stuff what I semantically wanted it to be. So that you know, what do you think about generated markup with a CMS? I mean, is it something that you have had to work with? And what, you know, if so, what kind of challenges did you face?
Yeah, so I think that starts with choosing the right CMS that has a really robust developer community and has strong plugins, because not every CMS is just going to have out of the box exactly what you need based on the content or the client requirements, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So doing your research ahead of time and choosing a platform that has really nice plugins, but then again doing research before you select a plugin to make sure that the markup that is generated is semantic at the very least, you know, I guess that's what you're hoping for. And there's always going to be times where you're unfortunately doing things with templates that's just kind of like, well, this has to be done. So if you have to wrap that form in a div, you know, and have a class on it and then target it that way, then so be it. There's, you know, checks and balances kind of a thing. So while it might be less than ideal, it is still kind of for the greater good as you're moving the project forward. You know, those kinds of things happen. I haven't run into them too much with Expression Engine, thankfully. I know Drupal generated some markup that was less than ideal that we had to kind of work around. But then it's just like going in with CSS and kind of cleaning it up where possible, you know, just kind of is what it is. It's less than ideal to begin with, but I think that there are appropriate solutions for it to make it like at least print appropriately, and then worrying about accessibility after the fact. You have to go in and if you can clean it up. I mean, that's also reaching out to the developer of the plugin if possible, or, you know, and like asking for advice on like how to tackle this problem, that kind of thing. So just making sure that you're asking the right questions, and if you need to make updates, then so be it.
Yeah. I encountered this issue myself recently for a project we're just finishing up this week. It was there's no other way. I was pissed off by the whole thing. So basically we decided to use Structure for an Expression Engine site to manage primarily our goal was to have it manage the navigation of the site. But the markup that Structure spits out for, let's say, for example, the primary navigation on a site, it's limited and there isn't a whole lot you can do to modify it. And this was a responsive site, so there was a need for a few mobile toggles in place and a need for some special classes on the child. You know, there was secondary dropdowns. And it was, so my template, the markup was beautiful. And then I dropped Structure and I was like, oh, crap, I can't actually do what I need to do, especially from a responsive standpoint with the markup that it generated. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity to customize it. So I found a plugin for a plugin. So it's called, what was it called? Structure. Oh, I'm blanking.
Entries.
Structure entries.
I think so.
And that lets me generate my own kind of nested UL structure. But it was a hog in terms of query resources. Mm-hmm. I mean, the page was like 8 seconds to load after it was done parsing. And thank God there are like caching tools. We used CE Cache from Aaron Walden, and it kind of resolved the issues I was having. But I spent way too much time trying to get that to work, to the point where in my mind, I can't think of a reason to use Structure again, especially if we're going to be doing responsive builds where I do need more customization of my navigation.
Yeah, I wonder how else you would approach that. Like in my head, I was thinking, like, what if you, like, take JavaScript and you, like, rewrite it? But that's, like, not – that's stupid. No.
It's one of those situations where, like, you can always find a way to work around it if you have enough time and enough – you're just going to get it done. You're convinced
tenacity,
yourself.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of like, was it worth it? I kind of wish I had never chosen that add-on in the first place. I feel like I could have done something differently, even with native Expression Engine right out of the box, that would have been faster than what I had to deal with, what I thought was going to make my life easier.
Oh, yeah. And because once you go the Structure route, you're kind of pigeonholed.
You're in it.
You're not going to, because you have to restructure the entire CMS. So, that's a tough one.
Yeah, it was a good lesson learned in the sense of it's going to make me a lot more careful about what we recommend for that particular functionality in Expression Engine moving forward. And I'm going to be a lot more focused on paying attention to what, regardless of what the CMS is, what that markup is. You know, just to make sure that I'm not digging a hole for myself that's going to take me forever to get out of.
Yeah, that's actually surprising to me because Structure is a very, I mean, I've used Structure before. We've used Structure in client projects and it's like very well received and well
respected. Up until now, I have used it and loved it. Yeah. And I still love it. It's just that for that need to generate for nested responsive ULs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I needed to throw toggles in there and I needed to do different things that I couldn't do with my skill set and that plugin.
Mm-hmm.
So it was crazy.
But, you know, speaking as maybe a devil's advocate, is there ever any situation really where generated markup is necessary?
I wish it wasn't. I feel like people who build add-ons have their skill set and it may mm-hmm. not be markup.
Yeah.
You know, just output the data. Let me do what I'm good at. Let me have the flexibility to control what the markup should be for a site because that's what I'm good at. That's my opinion.
Allison, how about you?
Yeah, no, I agree with you entirely. You know, I guess it's not a perfect world or, you know, there's going to be, you know, like there's always limitations, that kind of thing. So I think also though we're in creative problem solving. That's part of our job. So, you know, finding the solutions to those kinds of problems, you know, that kind of makes my day a little more exciting. So while I, you know, don't, you know, wish them upon anyone, I, you know, sometimes working around those problems, you know, that are going to come up with all the third parties that we work with as developers, there's going to be snags and that kind of a deal. And like finding the most appropriate solution is a challenge, but they're not the best, but you know, they're not,
It's the ones you learn the most from. It's fun to solve problems,
you know?
I think that's the stuff you learn the most from when you really have to deal with something like that.
Yes, and do like a deep dive into mm-hmm. something that you're not familiar with and just kind of being forced to do it because there's no, I do well when, you know, I'm like back in a corner and there's no other options and you just have to make it work and you have to learn this. And that's how, you know, that's kind of how I thrive, at least, you know, as far as my skill set goes, which has its pluses and minuses for sure. But when I'm forced to learn something because I have to, you know, then I'll do it and I'll be a better dev for it. So
speaking of helping yourself become a better dev, if you were speaking to a CMS developer right now and they're asking you how to improve your workflow, job in life, what would you ask them to do to make templating and manipulating markup easier for a CMS?
I don't know. I feel like it's more my job to help them with their job than it is for them to help me with my job. But I think just having like a really sound collaborative kind of partnership and making sure that we're communicating and bringing problems like up early before they become a big problem is mm-hmm. kind of key, just having open communication. I start from my starter files and my constraints are far less than what they're dealing with working in a CMS and having to, you know, deal with all the CMS overhead. So I kind of have the attitude that I'm trying to make their lives easier, which maybe in turn they have the attitude that they want to make my life. But, you know, I don't know. I just feel like making sure that both people are kind of like working together to make sure that the end product is what it should be and where it needs to be, really gets the job done.
Now, before we finish up the episode today, do you have any final pieces of advice for those of us who are templating for a CMS?
Yeah, just really focus on when you're writing your CSS, do yourself a favor and look for the common patterns across the design system and write those first and then override carefully when necessary. But if you have your sound base to begin with and all your low-level or I guess high-level CSS is written early, you'll reduce a ton of time in the long run. Yeah, and then also just having those starter files, just making sure that you're maintaining them, updating them, and be very comfortable with them. So when you look at the design, you just kind of already know what it should be classed and what kind of style should go along with that and then where it needs to be overridden. I guess also avoiding the body classes as well, except in like certain very specific instances mm-hmm. Because they're so high level and they can become troublesome quickly. And just, using those sparingly and keep away from importance, that kind of deal. Yeah. And just learn basic preprocessors. Learn SESS. That's key. That would be my biggest one. Learn that.
Yeah, it sounds like just really good foundational workflows and naming conventions and approaches.
Yes.
Perfect. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us, Allison.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
We loved it. In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
My Twitter handle is Allie Wagner, A-L-L-I-W-A-G-N-E-R. And you can shoot me an email, wagner@happycog.com. Yeah, that's about it.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Awesome. Thank you.
We'd now like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Squarespace and Pixel & Tonic.
We also want to thank our partners, Arcistech, Devotee, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter @ControlClickCast or visit our website, ControlClickCast.com.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll be talking with Ben Parizek about craft plugins. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, ControlClickCast.com/schedule. For more upcoming topics,
this is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.